Hi, I'm Scott Cooper, and this is the Tales from the Trail podcast by Matchplay. In this episode, Justin Chesham, head men's coach at Christopher Newport University, and I welcome Felipe Barretario, head women's coach at Emory and Henry College. Felipe discusses the ins and outs of women's soccer and Division II college soccer and what the process is to become a student athlete. This is great insight into what it takes to be recruited at any level of college soccer.
Today's episode is brought to you by Pitch Invaders, the online apparel business dedicated to fostering community and growing soccer in the heart of America. Based in the vibrant soccer hub of Arlington, Virginia, Pitch Invaders proudly champions their slogan, "The Pitch is for the People." Their mission? To unite soccer enthusiasts nationwide through their unique blend of casual and athletic gear. But Pitch Invaders isn't just about clothing. They're about collaboration, partnering with clubs, associations, and more. They create exclusive merch designs that promote their brands together. And here's the kicker. Partners receive a revenue split on collaborative merch sales to help support them. From the streets to the stadium, Pitch Invaders products boast soccer-related sayings on the back like, "You got nutmegged," "Press machine," and "Golazo getter." So whether you're cheering from the stands or dominating the field, gear up with Pitch Invaders and join the movement. Visit pitchinvadersusa.com to explore their latest collections and become part of something bigger. Use the code MATCHPLAY at checkout for 15% off your purchase. Pitch Invaders, the pitch is for the people.
I don't really see much else out there. So where do you
need to go to Bristol?
What's that?
You probably need to go to Bristol.
Oh, okay. How far is that drive?
20 minutes.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
15, 20 minutes, not at all.
Yeah. Is that where you live?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's more stuff there.
Yeah, yeah.
How close are you to like Christiansburg and Blacksburg?
It's like 1 hour.
Okay.
We are exactly 1.5 from Radford. So okay. Around 1 hour from Virginia Tech.
Gotcha.
Yeah, you're close. Past all of that, past down further south, down 81. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool, man.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, we're talking with Felipe Barretario from Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Which is in the southwest corner of Virginia. He's the head women's coach of the women's soccer, head women's coach, the women's coach at the college there. So, and you can tell once Felipe starts speaking that he has an accent. He's from Portugal, which I think is really cool. There's just different perspectives of soccer coming in and teaching and coaching and that sort of thing. So, give us a story of growing up and how you ended up here.
Yeah. So, first of all, thanks for having me. It's a good opportunity. I played in Portugal. Since I was, in Europe, especially in Portugal, soccer is the only sport and soccer only. So if you don't play soccer, you're kind of weird. That's the way they see you a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was always happy that I had a great support from my family. So I always play at a very good level. By the time I was 16, I have played already in two different professional academies of youth and stuff. So I was very blessed. By the time that I was 16, I signed a contract, like an academy contract, and I'll start training with professionals.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the time, but I was in, it's a team called Estoril, which now is in the first division. They're always between first and second division in Portugal, but now they are in the first division, and I start training with them sometimes. It was a great experience, but honestly, I recognized right away that I was not good enough. I was good enough to be second, third, fourth string, but I couldn't make a living out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, one of my old coaches from the youth academy, he opened this company who sends players abroad. And he mentioned about the US college system and scholarships and while you study, and he showed us, he showed us the beautiful stadiums there's in US with college and thousands, hundreds of people on the stands and all that stuff. So I did some research, and I ended up coming to Kentucky first. I went to a small school in Barville, Kentucky, called Union College. At that time, we were in NIA school, so at that time, we were number 5 in the nation. extremely competitive program. I mean, we had a squad around 29, maybe. I'm not completely sure. I can't remember top of my head, but I would assume 29, 30. And we had like five Americans. So the rest was all international. Portuguese, you know, Italian, French, Jamaica, you know, you name it. We had it all. Extremely competitive. And then I stayed there for 3 years because I was doing college already in Portugal. So I was a transfer when I came here. And then I just ended up staying here. I ended up staying here. Before I moved to Emory, I was actually at King University, which is another Division II school, but I was on the men's side. Mm-hmm. And then I made a transition to Emory in Virginia, which is right 20 minutes down the road from King, to the women's side. And I got a working visa, which was painful, but I got it. So all good now.
Cool.
So when you were looking at all the great things of America from Portugal, were you expecting what you expected when you arrived in Kentucky?
So when I came to US, my first thoughts was I'm going to be professional.
Right.
That's what I thought right away. I'm going to play MLS. I remember my father talked to me about that. Because again, I was blessed to play such a good level. I mean, I play with guys, and I'm not trying to be arrogant, but I say this in an arrogant way because it was a privilege. I mean, I play against guys who, Ruben Dias from Manchester City, Gonçalo Guedes, who's at Benfica now, Renato Sanches, who's at PSG, now he's leaving, I guess, but I play against all those type of guys. I mean, it was a blessing, you know, it was awesome. And then when I was about to come to US, I'm going to be professional. But when I came here, I joined NIA, which I didn't know much about the leagues at that time. And I only knew NCAA and IA, but I thought NCAA was the top. And when I came to NIA, and I knew there was not a lot of rules or, you know, black and white rules, right?
Right.
It was a different breed. I mean, every single team had more than half of the squad of international, the background similar, even better than mine. So, you know, it was incredible. But yeah, answer your question. I was disappointed in a way that was too good than what I thought it would be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so was a good type of disappointment, if that makes sense. I was the only thing I was bad disappointing was when they sell coming to US, they sell about all these beautiful stadiums with thousands of people on the stands and all the facilities, all the gear, all the equipment. But there are thousands of schools in the United States, and some of them don't have the same facilities and same conditions as other ones.
Yeah.
In my school in Kentucky, we had a fantastic program in terms of competition, in terms of, you know, athleticism, you know, in terms of individual talent. But in terms of, you know, gear, equipment, we were not the best ones, if that makes sense. So it was kind of disappointing on that standpoint.
That's why I was asking, because you ended up in Kentucky. And you know, most, like when I think of Portugal, I think of like Lisbon, you know, like some.
That's beautiful. Where I live.
Right, but I could have also ended up in some small Kentucky version in Portugal and be like, oh, this is not what I expected at all. You know, a lot of the international kids that I've worked with or coached, you know, one kid came over from Averett and in Danville, Virginia. It's pretty close out there where you are. And he was like, yeah, I was expecting, you know, New York City and Los Angeles, and I ended up in Danville, Virginia. There's nothing wrong with Danville. It's just it's such a different area. And so, you know, it's interesting you talk about that. It's like, yeah, Emory and Henry and Christopher Newport, and we are much different spots than, you know, Ohio State or here in Virginia Tech or UVA and some of these big dogs that, you know, you go to their facilities and you're like, oh, this is a little different, you know. So it's I'm always curious when an international guy comes over, it's his first time in the States, and he ends up, you know, not in New York City or LA or a big time city, and, you know, just what that shock is like.
No, but I mean, and I agree with you, because actually, so when I got into this company that, you know, like we do, right, recruiting internationals, the same agencies, when I got into that company, I had cousins in New York, like third-degree cousins, and I asked them, hey, can I come over so I can take a look at US? And even though I was not talking to any school yet, because it was a one-year process, so I was like, let me just see if I like US. And they're from New York. So right. I went to New York, I watched Manhattan, I was in Long Island next to the beach, and then I ended up in a town with 50 people in Kentucky, middle of nowhere. I mean, it was different.
Yeah.
There
you go.
Talk a little bit about, like, the difference in the youth system. Like, here it's kind of pay to play, and over there, you know, you get into an academy and that sort of thing. And, you know, just compare and contrast you know, the systems.
Well, that's a discussion of a lifetime, isn't it? I know in US that's a big, that's a big thing. So yeah. I mean, back home again, I cannot talk by entire Europe because I'm only from Portugal, but I have friends from different countries, and from my understanding is all the same. But you know, here is pay to play, where in Portugal there's no pay to play at all. You pay when you are a little kid because, you know, you are in those youth academies and stuff. But once you reach around 10, you stop paying at all. Actually, it's when they start paying you. You know, not necessarily when you're 10, but like I said, when I was 16, I had a contract and I was making money already. Not a lot, but I was covering costs. That was another reason why I didn't go NCAA as well.
And they had...
You know, and the system is different. First of all, you know, you go here with all respect to all youth coaches, but you go to some coaches, for example, and depends on location as well. I mean, I go to Barberville, Kentucky. It's hard to find soccer at all there. There's really almost no opportunities. And the ones that there are, I mean, the coaching is extremely poor. I mean, some of them are parents who, with all respect, are just trying to help kids, just trying to get them some exercise, some activity. But I mean, in Portugal, you know, the coaches are good, you know, in youth system. I mean, there's a reason why our team is so good and why our soccer is so developed in our national team is incredible. I mean, the coaches are amazing. I coached some teams back in Portugal, a youth, and it's funny because I used to coach a club around here, and the parents would ask me, what's the difference between, you know, our age, under 14, and under 14 that you coach back home? And I was like, the difference was here in US, when I coach a game, the parents are like, kick the ball forward, run, score, you know. But in Portugal, at the end of the game, the parents would come to me and say, hey, why the hell did you change the formation? Or why you didn't change it? Why did you leave two center backs? Why you didn't add an extra third man? You know, like, it's much more tactical because people know the game, you know.
Yeah, it seems like it's starting to get that way a little bit. I mean, I think our national team is, you know, at least talent-wise, the best it's ever been, you know, across the board in terms of overall talent. And I think across the country, it is a growing sport. It always has been. But, you know, to your point you made earlier, in Portugal, I mean, everybody plays soccer. And here they play. I mean, I grew up playing baseball, and I signed up for basketball, and I signed up for football. And, you know, I just played a little bit of everything growing up. And, you know, up until, geez, I think I was 13, 14 years old before it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't someone like my father coaching my soccer team. And so, and I actually still have the book sitting on my desk right here, but over my head, of like Soccer for Dummies, that I just took from my dad from, you know, the late 80s. I just thought it was such a, I was like, what a funny book. I don't know if they have.
Hey, once in a while, we all need it.
Hey, you know, there might be something in there, you know, it's interesting to hear, you know, the differences. I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, it's such a big monster here. And how much of the pay to play versus non-paying to play is driven through having, you know, like you were with Porto, I believe. Is that correct? I mean, you guys are making somewhat of a bit of money through your top team. You know, like there's a lot of coin. You sell one of your players, you could pay all your salaries for a couple of years there. So, you know, what is the difference there? Because there isn't a pro team in town here to funnel the money down. And so, you know, where else would the money come from is basically the question across the country here. So, you know, like what is that like? I mean,
so the biggest thing for me is, and that's what I've always said to parents, friends, other coaches, is you here pay to play, but you have fantastic facilities. You know, not necessarily facilities, but you have all the gear. You have shoes. You have, I've seen kids with three different travel pants, and, you know, they have multiple stuff. And kind of what you ask, I mean, the country helps a lot the clubs in terms of funding. Like you said, the top dogs, the top teams feed themselves from sales that they made and sponsors and all that stuff. And and that is like a channel for all the youth sport of that club. But it's a challenge because, you know, except, you know, top teams, like I was in my youth academy was not a top team, but was from a professional club. Right. But still, our conditions were okay. But if you go to Benfica, Sporting Porto, they all have great, great, you know, all the gear, all the facilities. They go to the games by bus, for example. But while you are in the small clubs, you don't have the same quality. Like, sure. Okay, you don't pay to play, sure, but you don't get travel pants. You might get one travel pants that was worn by the professional players like 5 years ago. So it's little, you know, it's I even tell you a funny story. When I was in Studio, there was a guy in a professional team called Seba. Seba was a guy, I don't even know his playing anymore. I don't even know his nationality, maybe Brazilian, I'm not sure. This guy was a beast. Was a well built guy. His quads were massive. So when the professional team, you know, turned in all their gear and sent it to us, you know, the shorts had the numbers, but nobody could use his number because his quads were so big that the shorts were all stretched out. So a guy, you know, wear these shorts and he looked like a skirt, literally. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think that kind of answers your question in a way that, sure, here you pay to play and you might not get the best talent because you're going to miss talent for sure. Some kids just cannot afford it. Sure. And while in Portugal, you get the best talent, but not necessarily the best facility. I mean, you go to fields. I mean, honestly, since I was in US, I don't think I've ever seen a bad turf field, if that makes sense. Even in club, like if we're talking about a well-established club, right? A well-established club, I don't think I've seen a really, really rough turf, like with the turf coming apart or something. Right. While in Portugal, oh yeah, 100%. My club, my youth academy used to be one of them until they changed the turf. So, you know, it's does answer your question. I think it comes from sales. The clubs need to help their youth, but the smaller clubs, they don't have conditions. And also the biggest challenge is, it goes by the region. So, okay. For example, Estoril in my region was one of the top teams. If I play one of those little clubs and if I'm good enough, they're going to take me away right away. Yeah. They're going to find me, scout me, and say, talk to my parents, say, you're coming with us. So the small teams, it's the chance of survival is not very high.
Yeah.
That's why I feel UEFA a while ago create those, I think it's like Youth Academy incentives. I don't know the name in English, but basically, you know, when they sell the player, they go by, it's by the rights of formation, right? The rights of academy. Right. So if you spend 10 years in the Youth Academy of this club, you need to pay a percentage of that sale to that club.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a way to help with, you know, balancing numbers and everything.
Yeah, I could be wrong. There was a kid who was based out of, I think it was out of Richmond, and he signed a big deal in Europe and a multi-million dollar deal. And he left as a kid. And the club that he came from, they didn't see a dime. I guess U.S. soccer takes that money. I guess that all these kids are U.S. soccer kids, not necessarily the local club that they play for. So the local club didn't see a dime, and they lost their best player for $1 million contract or however much the kid made. And I definitely found that to be a little odd. I mean, how many clubs over there are just, they can sell a guy and they won't even try to sign him. They know that, like, oh, I'd rather sell this kid for tens, 20, 30 millions of dollars. And I'll be able to pay for 10 guys and, you know, my whole staff, or get a new training facility like you talked about. I mean, you get a super special kid, that's where you can now change your program, even though that kid will never finish his career with you, of course, unless he kind of comes back at the very end.
Yeah, and it's so hard because it's hard to balance both things. It's hard for you to want to have an extremely competitive squad and having, you know, the youth and young players. But at the same time, I mean, you know, a Portuguese team cannot deny an offer of $40 million or 40 million euros for a
club. Yeah, you know, that.
It's a lot of money for Portugal.
Right.
You can't say no.
I will sell every one of my players for that amount right now. I know it's college, it's not legal. But if you want one of my guys and you're going to give me that money, I'll break the rules. I'll see you later.
We'll fly everywhere. No
right,
more bus.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a big challenge. I mean, it's definitely a big challenge. But another thing that I was shocked when I found out in US was I started learning when I came to US as a student because my cousin, one of them, played in the club, and they explained me a little bit. And I actually did a summer internship when I was on my undergrad in East Team, and I learned a little bit. And I was shocked how in US, I'm going to say you guys because you guys are Americans. You guys have like guest players, and shocking to me. It's completely unrealistic. It's completely different than.
Well, you started in your town. You played for your town's team. Mm-hmm. Like here in the States, once you start to get to a certain level. I mean, especially up in like Northern Virginia, super saturated areas where there's lots of teams. you will see kids, well, I'm going to go to the team 40 minutes away or up there. That could be much longer, just because it's the better team or this coach is there or whatever. And you'll see people jump and ship immediately. There's no like, hey, everybody from Fairfax plays for Fairfax, or everybody from here, Williamsburg or Newport News or Emory, stays in town and plays. No, I mean, if you have a superstar kid from there, he's leaving. Oh. He's going to go to the nearest team. It could be an hour, hour and a half drive, whatever. And he's going to go play for that team in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it comes, you know, with the soccer opportunities in the area as well. You know, sometimes the towns don't have, you know, any opportunities. I mean, you know, where I'm at, we have Johnson City, which is almost 1 hour away. Mm-hmm. There's where I was coaching club. And the club is good, but I mean, you have players there who could go somewhere else, and they are just guest players in some ECNL teams, for example.
Right.
You know, and it's tough because, again, not everything. I thought about this before. I just don't know what the solution would be, in a way that the country is so big. You know, it's so big that it's hard to bring soccer to everyone in a fair amount of time, a fair amount of price. And, right. You know, it's really, I don't know what the solution would be, honestly. When I talk to my friends in Europe, they ask, how is US so big and the soccer is not even half of what it could be? And I was like, I think you answer your own question.
Right.
The fact that they are so big is what make more difficult.
Yeah.
But also, let me add what you said about the growth of soccer before. I agree with you. I think it's growing a lot. I think there's better coaches, there are better players as well, more players.
Sure.
But I agree with you. I just feel part of me thinks that you will never go extremely far because of the culture, if that makes sense. You know, yeah. There are so many of the sports, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like I told you, I mean, in Portugal, it's soccer and soccer. If I tell my father, hey, I'm quitting soccer to go play volleyball, he's going to say, listen, you have no idea what you're talking about. You stay in your team, you know. And here, there's a lot of other sports. You know, it's, I think that cultural side of it, I don't think it helps neither.
Yeah, I agree. And I always think of, I mean, look at the best, who are the best athletes that play soccer right now? I mean, you know, they're some incredible athletes. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think soccer is filled with athletes across the world. But here in this country, our absolute best athletes, while we do have some great athletes playing soccer, I mean, they're playing basketball, playing football. I mean, they're playing different sports. And I always giggle, people ask you, like, what if, like, LeBron James was a soccer player? I mean, you know, like, who's going to stop that guy if he had started kicking a ball at, to your point, I mean, these kids are playing at 4 or 5 years old. If he started now, he'd never even make, you know, any type of pro environment. Of course, it's too late. But, I think you're right. I think the culture is definitely going to hold us back. And, you know, you talked about how you could be a kid at 12, 13 years old and get signed and shipped off. And, I mean, parents don't do that here. I mean, you'll hear some of them will do that a little bit. But for the most part, it's parents like, no, my kid's going to stay here until they're 18 and then they can leave, you know, that type of deal. Very rarely do you see them shipping their kid off. And the best kids, they're usually in some sort of professional environment by what age? Would you say 14 at the latest? I mean, they need to be in a professional training type environment. And, you know, those aren't everywhere across our country. So parents are gonna have to get rid of their kid at a much earlier age. And they just don't want to do that. I got kids now. I can't imagine them 14 years old saying, see you, dad, I'm going to go do some homeschool, high school thing, go live in Philadelphia or something. I couldn't imagine doing that.
Yep. I agree.
Were you at Porto when Mourinho was there?
No, I was too young.
Did you ever meet that guy?
I've seen him, but I never had the privilege.
I tell you what, man. I you say what you want about him, man. He gets after it. I like it.
If you watch Netflix, there's a show called, I think it's Playbook or The Coach's Playbook, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's extremely interesting. It's a show where it has, I think, 8 episodes, I think. And it's like each episode is a different coach from multiple sports. So okay. The first episode is Doc Rivers from Boston Celtics, and now the and then one of them is Mourinho, and he talks about coaches and Chelsea and stuff, and Inter as well. I mean, it's amazing.
It's amazing. So it's all coaches on there.
All coaches.
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic.
They talk about their experience, and they always, like, within the episode they mark by chapters, like some type of lesson for you to learn as a coach. And it was cool, like, for example, I remember the part that marked me the most, honestly, it's not even soccer, but when Doc Rivers said every single meeting every year, especially in every single team that he has, he always starts by saying, "Hello, my name is Doc Rivers. I'm your head coach. But before a head coach, I'm a human being. I'm going to make mistakes. I have a lot of things I'm good at. I have a lot of things I'm terrible at. But I'll make mistakes." And yeah. I just thought it was funny how we see these guys on TV making millions of dollars a year. And they are just human, just like us, and you know, yeah, all that type of stuff.
Well, if you think about it, once you cross onto a field, obviously soccer is different than basketball, then different than football. But on the sideline or in the locker room or on the bus or just in your office, it is the exact same game. I mean, we're all just dealing with, you know, young men in our field, or these guys are professional athletes. And you can't tell me that the professional athletes in the office of Doc Rivers are any different than the professional athletes in the office of Mourinho. You know, I'm sure they're dealing with the same challenges. And so the X's and O's may be different, but really we're all dealing with the same types of people, same types of kids. And so there's so much crossover, so much to learn from other sports, and all the top coaches across all sports, they have so much that you can give you. I mean, like Tony Dungy's books were such a hit for everybody that coached any sport. I mean, you just can learn so much from all the crossover.
I can even tell another story. I don't know, Scott, if you're on the time, if you have more questions, but
no, keep going. Yep.
My first practice in a professional academy, I remember like it was yesterday. Portugal is a very tiny country, extremely tiny. We have two islands, which is called Madeira and Açores, which is like you need to go by plane or by boat, but normally people go by plane. And we were in a national league of under 19, I believe. I can't remember top of my under 19, under 18. And we were going to play to the islands against a professional team, a professional academy team, which is called Nacional, which is in the second league right now. But that was a game that us as kids, we were waiting the entire year long because we were going to fly. Because in Portugal, we didn't fly anywhere. We always go by vans, bus, normally vans, honestly. And we wouldn't fly anywhere. So that game was a game that we had marked in our calendar saying, this is awesome. We're going to fly, we're going to be hotel, and we were kids playing the professional academy, but still we are not professionals yet. So we are going to look like professionals. So I remember we were going to leave on a Friday to fly, train there, and on Saturday we would play. And on Thursday night, my coach, in the middle of practice, my coach pulled me off practice and said, "Hey, Philippe, I just want to let you know, I want to talk to you first. You're not traveling with us tomorrow." And as you can imagine, I was 16 years old. I was like, what the hell? I've been waiting for this game for months now, since August, since preseason start. And then I remember like it was yesterday. He turned to me and he said, and I was like, why? And he was like, well, you're not traveling with us because you belong to them now. And the expression "to them" in the club means you go downstairs, because we had the youth academy facility and right downstairs was a professional stadium. So it was like, you belong to them now. And you literally point towards the stadium. I was like, okay, that's a change now. Yeah. So on Friday, I had to leave classes because I had to train with the professionals at 3 p.m. So my father took me, drove me on the car. Can you imagine like all those guys arriving with freaking Porsche, some Ferraris and stuff. And I was in my dad's car, Opel Corsa, I think, and just driving down and see you, Dad. And I remember I just arrived. And I was so shy because, I mean, those were the guys who I see on TV, you know. And it's funny how you're saying about all the under so normal. I mean, I'll hear these guys talking about cars, about girls, about parties, you know, in the locker room, on Facebook, social media. So I thought after two or three sessions, I was like, these guys are exactly like me. Right. I mean, they have the same ideas. They have same thoughts. They make the same mistakes. You know, I just always was curious, you know. I remember when we started training, we were waiting on the line. I remember guys saying, well, my agent could talk to this agent to see if I could get out of here. You know, like it was just funny to hear them talk about, you know, stuff that you don't hear on TV, you know, and you can see how normal they are compared to us. Sometimes we put them such a high pedestal and they are exactly like us. And for me, the biggest difference was everything they did mostly had a purpose. And everything they did was almost perfect, if that makes sense. I think that's the biggest difference. Yeah, like, you know, how normally, you know, us, you know, we do technical work where it's almost like 5-yard pass, returning and all that stuff. Well, the girls, the guys miss maybe 4, 5 out of 10, sometimes even more. Right. And these guys miss one, maybe. You know, right. It's much more consistent. It's incredible. It's a good level.
I was talking to a buddy. Scott knows him too. He played professionally in Germany for a few years. He actually had a long career over there. He grew up in our systems here, played high school soccer and the whole nine yards there. But when he went over to Germany, we were asking him, what are the training sessions like? He goes, well, a lot of the drills are very similar to the drills that we even do in America. You know, it's not like I can't look up a really good drill from Germany, you know. He said, but the difference is we'll do it for an hour at world-class speed, and you're not allowed to make a single mistake. And so all these professional guys are just dialed into this simple drill. Like, I mean, I'm talking box passing, you know, something where it's just super simple and you will have to be perfect for the entire time. And it's such a hard concept to really explain to the college athlete. I mean, to ask them to be perfect like that. I mean, there's probably not even the top Division I teams in the country. I'm sure that their drills, their balls are scooting off and going up against the fence, or they have to keep extra balls near the area just so that they can jump back in and not lose too much precious time during their training sessions. I mean, it really was eye-opening to hear how the drills are similar, but man, it is crisp, it's perfect, and it's demanding at that high of a level.
We have this idea, which I think mainly came from Guardiola, honestly. We have this idea where for us to be great coaches, we need to have this different type of sessions where they do flips while passing the ball and, you know, like this, mm-hmm. this random sessions. And the more I study, the more I read, the more I do all of this, I was like, the biggest difference for me between an okay coach and a great coach is, first of all, the session goes in according of the topic that you want to coach and the communication. That's key. That's key. 100%. Sometimes not even realize that. How do we communicate with the girls and the guys? How do we explain the message? I think that's what makes a great coach.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I was doing one of my licenses recently, and I went to my license and I was like, hell, you know, it's a room with 30 other coaches, we all talk about the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, well, we all know a lot about soccer, but the biggest difference is who can explain the message the best. Yeah. And it was funny because when we run our sessions for the license, you could see who was more comfortable with the explanation of the drill, the getting the main topics, the retention of the information from the players compared to others. And I think that's what makes a great coach. Honestly.
Yeah. I was at a session once. I think it was Tony DiCicco. I think he passed away recently. He was a women's goalkeeper, or it was a coach. I want to say his specialty was goalkeeping, but I want to say he was on the head coach for the women as well. You know, may have won World Cup or Olympics or something like that. But he said something super profound to me. I'm sitting there. We got our pen and paper. We're about to just copy down this drill. There's cones everywhere. We're excited to see this professional coach do a drill. I was a young coach at the time. And he goes, all right, I got the best secret for you. If you want to be a good coach, you got to get good players. But if you want to be a great coach, you got to get great players. I was like, oh, yeah, that's let me just write that down and leave here. But, I mean, that's, you know, kind of a segue here. I mean, that is our job. I mean, how much easier is it for you to win at Emory and Henry if you've got, you know, 10 players that are better than 10 players you currently have? You know, same with me. I mean, I tell my guys all the time, my job is to recruit over you. I mean, I don't tell my guys, hey, I'm going to go get someone that I don't think is as good as you. It's just going to be your backup for 4 years. Like, no, I'm trying to recruit over you. That will take my program to the next level. And of course, your job is to make me regret doing all this recruiting. And then when I do bring in a kid, you don't let them pass you. I mean, that's your job. And, you know, so talking about recruiting specifically, you are at a very interesting place. You're at a D2 school, which there aren't a lot of D2s in Virginia, let alone, I think we said in the beginning, you're the only D2 girls team mm-hmm. in Virginia. But our two schools couldn't be further, you know, apart from each other, and even all the Division I's. And it's just, you're a great school. I think your average is like a 3.6 GPA. So you're getting really good kids too. But I don't think our recruiting could be any different. It really is bizarre. And so why don't you speak on that? Compare yourself to look at how many good schools there are in the state of Virginia, and yet you have to do it so different than all of us. And so what would you say is your biggest obstacle, or, you know, what would you say are your biggest differences, biggest challenges?
Yeah, I mean, speaking for what you said, I think the main topic comes with what you said, which is, when you said compare yourself, I think that's what we all can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's compare ourselves to others. I think especially when you are a young coach, I'm a young coach, you have this tendency of try to compare yourselves with others, and that will never happen. Because like you said, location is different. The profile of the student might be different. There's a lot more restrictions. Maybe, for example, our area around here, for example, for us to get a very good level of soccer, we probably need to drive between 1.5 to 2 hours.
Right.
While if you are in Blacksburg, if you are from Virginia Tech, I mean, you probably have quality soccer right on the road. You know, so it's like, you know, the biggest obstacle that we had was we have two obstacles. One of them, it's fixable. The other one, it doesn't depend on us. So the fixable one is the brand. We were Division III. We were not a great Division III program at that time. So our brand is not big enough. So when people think about Emory and Henry, people think right away of Emory, Georgia, which is a very good Division III school. So our brand is not good enough. So that's something that we tried to fix last year. But I think it's a continuous work that you need to keep doing, which is go to camps, expose yourself like we're doing right now. Podcasts, recruitment events, showcases, tournaments, ID camps. We try to attend all of it. Sometimes even events that we know we are not might be able to attend. But if you can get rosters, if you can get ourselves, you know, sometimes we do video of the event. We try to register for those events as well, just so kids can see our brand there. And I think that's important. We did a good job with that. We're having much more people interested from not just from Virginia, but from outside Virginia, including internationals.
Yeah.
I need to praise myself and my assistant. She left and she was Brazilian. I need to praise ourselves a little bit on that one. Part of the reason why we have more international interest is because we both were internationals.
Yeah.
So as you can imagine, like the biggest sell point for us is you can come play for me, be special, and you'll be training under an international coach who knows your struggles, know how bad it is to be far away from family, knows how to work out your visa, what you need to do to stay in US, while you can play for another school, while the coach is American, with all respect, but don't know all the steps that you need to take towards that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's a big selling point for internationals for us. The other obstacle that is not fixable is the location. It's something that, you know, it's something that you can't control, which is Emory is trying to do a hell of a job to, you know, provide more opportunities for the students. But we all know how kids are. Some of them just don't want to be engaged. Some of them, no matter what you do, you can do 25 parties in a week on campus for the kids. They don't care. They are not going to be happy. So I think that comes also with the recruitment profile of the type of, in my case, the type of girl you're trying to bring over. And try to understand what they are looking for, you know. And I think it's important when we bring them on a visit where, listen, are you looking for a place where you're going to be parties 24/7 and you have a massive city where you can go out? This won't be the place for you, mm-hmm. you know. And I think being transparent, I think that helps us, you know, helps our retention rate as well. Because kids realize right away, okay, he's being honest. This might be the right fit for me because I just don't like the place, which is fine. But location is a big thing. I don't know. I've never been at your campus. I don't know how your location looks like.
Sure.
But for us, I mean, it's a challenge.
Yeah, CNU's, I mean, Newport News is a city, and, you know, we're not far from a few great things that are, you know, off campus. You know, Hampton's right next door. Williamsburg's right next door. Chesapeake Bay, you know, the Atlantic Ocean. It's all pretty close. So, you know, there is more to do here than just be on campus, of course. So that definitely... That definitely is a driving factor of why, you know, especially Virginia kids would be interested in Christopher Newport. You being a Division II school, though, that gives you scholarship opportunities. Are you guys a fully funded D2?
No. Can
offer. So what is fully funded and what can you guys offer?
So like a fully funded at Division II is 9.9 scholarships. So right now we are about one third of that. So you know, it's been a challenge. It's something that we need to manage the right way. The way we try to do things, or the way we have been working on, the way our line of thought is any single Virginia kid, if Virginia Tech, Radford, Virginia University is not interested, or JMU, it should come to us first before going to any Division III school. That's how we are trying to look at it, because we can offer money.
Yeah.
So you know, if there's a kid who says, "Well, I'm interested between," you know, your school, you know, Bridgewater or whatever, we should be able to close the deal, just at least if it's just from a standpoint of financial. financial, and also the fact that we're playing a very competitive. I mean, our conference, I don't know if you're aware, I mean, South Atlantic Conference, extremely competitive Division II conference where, you know, at least for the women's side, including on the men's side, I mean, it's a lot of top teams in the country. I mean, Carson Newman, Catawba, Lenoir Ryan, we're talking about, I mean, massive stadiums, you know, a lot of fans. I mean, it's, competition is great. So that's the way we try to see it. I think the way we try to approach it is top Virginia kids, because there's a lot of good Virginia athletes, 100%, especially on your area, Northern Virginia. But we also need to combine with some out-of-state or even international kids.
Yeah.
I don't think not necessarily internationals, but out-of-state 100%. I think that helps, so, even to bring that.
It seems like a lot of Division II is international-based. To be honest with you, I don't really know much because there's just not a lot that I compete against. We don't play against Division II, but I don't really know a ton of Division II coaches. There's not a lot nearby. And so, but just from outside looking in, it looks like it's pretty heavy international. You look at the All-American Awards, it's almost everybody is not American. And is that pretty sound across the country that the top teams are usually pretty heavy?
So it's funny because I was talking to Scott, you know, even when you were not here. Mm-hmm. So my opinion, and after I've been on the women's side, I've been on the men's and women's side. So on the women's side, I don't necessarily think you need international to be successful. Okay. And the best example that I can give is you have Catawba, who, in my opinion, was probably the best team in our conference, national rank. By the time we faced them, they were number 9 in the nation. 2 years ago, made it to the semifinal, quarterfinal of the national tournament, so very good side. Over 90% of the team was from North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
All around that area. And actually, I was shocked. I even talked to Coach Etienne. I said, I don't know how you do it, but that's amazing. You know, how you have a team all local, you know, all made in North Carolina, and you're from North Carolina, the school, and you get, you know, all those kids. And we're talking about kids. I mean, they're the girl, I'll never forget her name, Katie Beck, incredible center back, who, for what he told me, she's going to play professional Australia. So, you know, a lot of good kids overall. But now on the men's side, you need internationals. You need internationals on the men's side, because the top, on the women's side, women's, they don't necessarily care about the level of the soccer, if that makes sense. Like, for what I mean by this is, if there's a kid who can go to Virginia Tech and play, but their major, it's not great over there, but she can come here and make six figures after she graduates, there's a big chance she might end up coming here. You know, it's much more professional oriented, academic oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But the men's side, they care a lot about the soccer part of it, you know, a lot of it.
Right.
And I would be surprised if you lost kids like that. Kids who just want to go to, you know, maybe Division I. I mean, a lot of kids end up going Division I, even though they might not play, but they just want to have that, you know, that status.
Sure.
But the point is, all the good American kids, they will end up going to Division I on the men's side. While, you know, on Division II, you can get internationals who can come here and they can influence right away.
Right.
I mean, in our conference, I mean, I remember I watched some of the men's game, and most of them or all of them. I changed what I said. All the teams who didn't have as many as internationals, they were the least succeeding teams.
Hmm.
So you need to have internationals 100%. They change the game.
Yeah, that seems like that's the case for Division II. And even in Division I, you're seeing a lot more internationals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were always playing here. You know, good players like yourself that you know, may have just missed out on some opportunity at home, you know, thought, man, I'll just come to the United States, get an awesome degree, and maybe be able to climb the ladder there and make it in the pros there. And so it's always been around. Even when I was a player in the late 90s, it was happening. And so, but it definitely seems like now more than ever, especially Division II, and then more and more in Division III than normal, the international thing. And of course, COVID exacerbated that, with Division I not being allowed to recruit for an entire year. I mean, a lot of those guys were like, all right, well, I'm just going to use a few of my bucks to go get some international kids. And I couldn't go recruiting anyways. I can't see the American kids play live. So it was such a tough thing. So you've seen the lasting effects from that.
I also feel that part of the reason why some Division I's are bringing more international as well is because some Division I's now, because of diversity and stuff, they are offering international scholarships as well.
Yep.
You know, from the institution. So that makes it way cheaper. I know a few schools around here, Division I, who they offer international scholarship, and they can even stack with athletic. So they can bring, you know, many good international kids.
Yeah. Now you'll see that, you know, men's side Division One is 9.9. And I think if you added up all the scholarships, though, at some of these places, I mean, they could be in the 20s if you add them all up, you know, between academic or, you know, any type of program that the school has. And so you'll see some of these teams will, they'll aim for a kid that fits a certain criteria and, oh, good, I can get this kid for free and it doesn't cost me a dime. You know, like that kid, of course, is going to present a lot more value to that program than maybe a kid that might value a little bit more, but it's going to cost them a full boat. So they're not going to take that kid. They're going to get the free kid and then go put their resources elsewhere. So I'm assuming you run into that issue from time to time. I mean, how much success do you have with in-state kids, with Virginia kids?
I mean, with Virginia kids, we have a lot of success.
Right.
And part of the reason is because what I told you guys about how the way we sell the program. You know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, you can come from the main point is you can come from, or you can come to a school who was a Division III school, was not that great. You can come now to Division II, one of the best conferences in the country, playing great soccer, you know, live, beautiful live broadcasting systems and all that stuff. And you can make history here. You know, it's a big sell and be part of the only Division II school in the state of Virginia. It's a big selling point. But even then, we see a lot of success on out-of-state kids. The only thing we have been missing a little bit is international kids because of financial.
Yeah,
financial has been the biggest issue. I just feel the investment in international kid right now on the women's side, it's too high for the outcome that you can get out of it. You know, I don't know. Do you have internationals in your team?
Not kids that are from. I mean, I've got kids that are international based, but I recruited them from Virginia somewhere. You know, they've been living here for the last few years. It's been a while since we had just a kid. He was an English guy, but he transferred to us from a school in state, so we didn't even recruit him out of England.
But I'm just saying because you know when you bring international, there's always a period of adaptation, isn't it? I mean, there are some kids who need at least 2 years to get used to the rhythm. Because the soccer is so different, you know, and I'm like, sometimes you're going to invest a big chunk of money in a kid that might take 2 years to explode, maybe. You can maybe split that money and get two good American kids who are already used to the system, you know. For example, an international kid who comes here doesn't understand why do we travel 5 hours to play, while an American kid, that's what she has been doing her entire life.
Right.
Even worse, playing CNL and all that stuff. So I think that's why women's always turning more to the to Americans instead of, you know, instead of international. And also, you know, soccer is extremely popular here in women's compared to, you know, in Europe. Unless a few countries like England as well, it's popular. But, you know, in Portugal, it's not popular.
And yeah, the conditions are different. Two or three countries in the world, too, for soccer from the women's side.
Yeah.
So, you know, the trickle down from that, kids that can't make it in the pros are still really good college level players. So it's definitely a different animal for recruiting, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you guys covered everything that I had written down to talk about. Is there anything else you guys need to add? That's fantastic.
I want to ask, you know, how has the men's team adjusted? Because we actually had a kid transfer to us a few years ago from Emory & Henry. I don't know if it was exact time that they went from 3 to 2 or maybe it was right after that. How has that transition gone for the men's team? And what are the challenges that are in place conference-wise or travel-wise that you talk about? I mean, like I said, there's not a lot to play against just in the state of Virginia alone. And so I just wondering what are your non-recruiting type obstacles you guys have to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, the transition of the men's has been difficult. Like I said, the main reason, financial. You know, if you cannot bring internationals, it's a challenge. You know, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, you can look, you can search their record. They didn't have a good season. But I also heard that, you know, part of the journey is always the first step. So it's not easy, and I think that's our frustration as coaches is I never heard of a coach who likes to lose, right? It takes some time to adjust. Even the coach who's here right now, he was a coach at, you know, when Emory was Division III, so coaching Division III to coach Division II, I think it requires a different approach from the coach.
Sure.
I think, I might be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel as a Division III coach, sometimes you can kind of wait a little bit more, like, because kids will talk to you sometimes. But as Division II, I mean, we're all looking at same people, if that makes sense. You know, if you stop talking to a kid for one day, she's already committed somewhere else. You know, it's whoever is offered more money. You know, normally, especially those best players, it's whoever is offering the more money. It's a challenge.
Yeah, D3 timelines are interesting. I mean, there's no money involved, so mm-hmm. My approach. All coaches have different approaches, but you know, I just had a kid here the other day, and I always ask timeline because I would like to know when they would like to be committed and what they're thinking, and then we kind of go from there. And I've always said the same thing. That's great. I love your timeline. That sounds fine. I get it. You want to wait another tournament or two, but I always tell the kids the same thing. I'm going to recruit or move forward assuming you're not coming to me, because if I don't get you, I'm going to want another kid that I also like just as much. And so if I do find that kid and that kid's ready to come right now, then I might give you a call and say, hey, you know, I need to know. So that'll be the only time I'll be kind of pushy with the timeline. You'll get different answers across the board there, but Division III in general. Yeah. You would imagine that if we're recruiting the top kids, these tweeners, these kids that are possibly going Division I, may go Division III, they're getting looks from both. And maybe there's a few bucks thrown to them in the Division I world where now I have to compete against someone that is getting a little bit of money. I'm not recruiting against some full ride kid, obviously, but a kid that might be getting a few bucks, yeah, they want to know. They want to know if they're going to get that money from the Division I school or Division II school. And so, you know, there is a little bit of a delay there, but it's you talk about culture earlier. There's a lot of, you know, good soccer players that are looking for specific things. And so, we're actually at a little bit of a luxury here at CNU where a lot of times I get to land those kids early. Yeah. And, but you're right. In general, you're right. Division III, we are a little more patient. You know, these kids are exhausting other options a lot of times in the beginning and seeing if the Division I or Division II world's there to throw them some money so that they can cut their costs down, which I totally understand, totally respect. It's their money, it's their time. So I totally understand that.
It's difficult because, you know, especially as Division II, we know we have money. So we need to run after the kids, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Well, for you guys, I mean, you know that about scholarship, there's nothing you can do.
Right.
It's a stack of money that the school offers from academic money. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I think you cannot be flexible about it. You know, probably they can apply for different types of other scholarships, but not athletic coming from you.
Right.
While us, I mean, if a kid says, well, I'm getting $3,000 from this place, well, I can maybe go back to my budget and see if there's any way that I can raise that above that those $3,000 to cut the costs.
Sure.
So it's a little bit more challenging, more frustrating as well, because I also feel that nowadays, and you probably felt that even at Division III level, Division I and NIA doesn't matter. I mean, I don't think necessarily there's a lot of ethical coaches down there. Mm. Not down there, sorry, around here. I think the more coaches feel pressure to win and stuff, I think ethics is being lost a little bit. So what that means is I've seen kids being recruited who you can clearly see they are not going to play, but the coaches keep feeding them, I don't want to say lies, but sure. But within 1 year, you'll see that kid in the transfer portal right away.
Sure.
And that sucks because I don't want to be that guy, and I bet you don't want to be that guy either. But sometimes you feel like saying, I told you so.
Yeah.
You know? And it's kind of frustrating because it changes the way the kids look. You know, the way the kids talk to coaches, the way the kids, you know, are recruited as well.
We talked about that topic quite a bit on this podcast where I think the biggest obstacle is they need to hear it from someone that they trust that's in the know. And I mean, to hear it from me or from you, it's like, well, I had a kid tell me this straight to my face. I asked him, like, well, what are you going to do? And, you know, he mentioned a couple schools. And I'm like, well, do you even know if you're going to play there? And he just kind of like totally blew it off and was like, you're only saying that because you're recruiting me. And, you know, right or wrong, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's like, oh, that's what the kids are thinking. It's like, he doesn't know me yet. He can't trust me yet. It's not his family or, you know, his top coach from the club or from high school. And if those guys aren't in the business or if those guys aren't directly talking to us and knowing exactly what our thoughts are on the kid, then they're going to get misinformation. It's just the way it is. And unfortunately, a lot of these kids will jump on the higher rated one that and not actually what's the best fit for them or what's going to get them on the field the quickest. It's going to be the one that they get to brag about the most. You see that, unfortunately, too much. And I think that if most of these kids can surround themselves with good people that are trusting and understand exactly what each coach is talking about and what they're all trying to do and what the best fit for them is, and someone that can actually speak to that stuff, then that'll help eliminate a lot of this, what you're talking about with the transfer portal. I mean, I think it's a good thing for a lot of kids because they can, you know, find the right homes, but it's also finding a lot of kids that are upset and they're in the portal for the wrong reasons. They're there because they feel like they may have failed with the decision that they had just made. And it'd be good to get rid of a lot of that. That'd be nice.
I agree. I know for a fact that a lot of kids are completely misinformed about the transport. You know, they don't realize the consequences of going to the portal, if that makes sense. Each institution has their own policies. You know, for example, my institution doesn't say anything about. I know some schools, if you ask to go in the portal, they take you away from the roster, take you from the website, cannot train anymore, and all that type of stuff.
Yep.
Whereas our institution advises not to do so. You know, I wish we could have control a little bit better on that. But still, you know, they advise us not to do so. But at the same time, I think the kids need to be accountable for that as well. You know, sure. I think, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's Division 1, 2, 3, and A. I mean, we are on the same boat. I think these generations coming up are different. Kids are getting different now. Kids, like, everyone thinks the grass is green on the other side. You know, everyone thinks that, you know, I love the school. The school is fantastic. I don't like the color of the uniform. I'm transferring. I know this is an exaggeration, but you know what I'm trying to say. You know, they see a small thing that they don't like. They like 90% of the school, 10% they don't like it. They're transferring. But they might go to a school who's way, way worse, you know, than what they have here or what they have there or what they have anywhere. I also feel like transfer portal doesn't, I don't know if you saw the stats, but I think the stats were saying that 50% or more than 50% of the kids who get into the portal end up staying in the portal. They don't end up going anywhere.
I believe that.
And I think that was around 20-30% who actually dropped the sport. And they end up not playing anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot into consideration because, you know, it's first of all, you're going to transfer. Where are you going? First of all, you need to have highlights. You have kids who don't have a scholarship, you know, in the school where they are, and they score zero goals, they play two games, they have zero assists, and they think they're going to get a bigger scholarship in some other school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, come on, we need to be realistic about that, you know, and I'm not trying to be mean, I'm just trying to be realistic, you know. And then also, I don't know what you think about this, but like, it creates a situation on the team where if I had, you know, two girls who play the same position and one of them wants to transfer, the other girl, and I'll let them try normally. One of the girls is going to be like, why is he investing time on her if she wants to leave and I'm staying? You know,
good question.
Which is fair. It's fair. I mean, I don't blame them to ask that. And then if their player who asks for transfer end up staying, there are bridges that are going to be broken a little bit sometimes, you know, because, I mean, I think all the coaches love where we are and we take really pride in our programs and ourselves and our team. And if a kid asks to leave and then end up staying, I mean, I think the trust breaks a little bit and it's built up again, you know. It's right. The same thing if you coach your team and your kids find out that you are applying for multiple different other teams, right? I don't think your kids will be very happy about that. You know, we ask commitment for the kids, but we need to give commitment back as well.
Yeah, I mean, the instant gratification of the current generation is very, very high in desire. I mean, it's shocking how few kids are willing to grind and fight it out and like, oh, I'm going to work my way into this role. And I mean, this is why we are very, very honest with all of our players. We're blunt with them. This is what you're walking into. You have the opportunity to start. You also have the opportunity to not play because they're also here and they're also good players. And you know, it doesn't matter what you tell them. There's a lot of kids that are like, well, I mean, I'm still unhappy, you know, for whatever reason. And, you know, it's interesting to your point about kids that are in the portal, not finding a home or just quitting in general. And I will reach out to Division I kids over and over and over again. And most of them are going to say the same thing. Like, well, I want to stay in Division I. I'm going to go find another home. And then very, very quickly, they're reaching back out because I am by far their best team that they can transfer to and go play. And I get Division I transfer all the time. That came from scholarship. And so it just shows the bigger issue of what they're doing in the process before they make the commitment to go to a school. And don't get me wrong. I've said this a million times. If you're getting a boatload of money, I get it. I mean, I got a five-year-old. If he's getting a big scholarship, that's going to push that school higher up on the list. I mean, I totally understand that. But if you're paying for school, you need to go look for, you know, all the details, you know, everything that matters. Would you spend this much money on a car or on a house or something really expensive without getting every single bell, you know, all the bells and whistles that you desire and everything that you want out of this huge, you know, burden on your family? It's a financial burden that you're going to have to overcome. And are you getting everything you want out of that? Do you want to be in the portal for the wrong reasons? And unfortunately, there's a lot of kids that are on there. And I was just on Instagram the other day looking, and it had this laundry list of people that just committed. And it always cracks me up because every kid that commits to Division I school, they always put commit to play Division I before they even put the school. I mean, it always blows my mind. It's like you just committed to like a great university, but you still want to talk about the division before you talk about the great university. I mean, it blows my mind. It really does.
And about you saying about, you know, finances and the burden and the finance. I mean, what I always tell, you know, the girls and the recruits is there's a reason when you go out and you go buy your cleats, you buy them from Nike, you don't buy them from Walmart, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I always say, sure, it might be expensive, might be a little bit more expensive than we anticipated. But if you're paying more, not always, but normally it can be that there's a reason why it's more, you know. For example, we are not a cheap school. I can tell that already. But part of the reason why I'm not cheap school is because our replacement rate in the first, you know, in the first 6 months after graduation is almost 100%. So that means in the first 6 months after you graduate, the chance of finding a job is almost 100% in the area of your studies.
Right.
So there's a reason why we're expensive, you know. So I always tell them at the end of the visit, you know, finance is extremely important. Like you said, 100%. They need to factor that out. But I don't think it should be the deal breaker, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Because there's a lot more. It's kind of like you said. Would you spend $50,000 on a house that has a hole in the freaking ceiling,
yeah,
or spend $100,000 on a house that is beautiful and everything fits just fine?
You know?
And honestly, if you do, again, I don't know if there's research about this, but I'm pretty sure in what I'm saying. If you do the research on these kids who end up going to the transfer portal, I promise you that a big chunk of them are kids who just went to their school because this is the cheapest option. You know, this is the cheapest option. And they end up in the portal because, well, it's cheap, but it's terrible as well.
Sure.
My experience, and when I say terrible, not necessarily academics or athletics, can be a mix of both, right? Because we both know that academics and athletics, you know, especially in college, is relatable, everything, you know? So if academics are not great, what's the point of playing there, you know? But also if academics are great, but if you are a good soccer player, you want to play, but if the soccer is terrible, that's not a point to be there either, you know? So I think it needs to be a mix, but again, I just don't feel that the financial needs to be the biggest deal breaker, if that makes sense, you know? It's an investment, like we said.
For sure.
All right.
Yeah, that was great. Felipe, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. It was fun.
Yeah. That's some of the differences that are there. And again, thank you for coming on. And we'll have to have you on again soon.
Let me tell you, Scott, I like this type of things because it's the first time I participate in one. But I like this type of things because, first of all, for us coaches, I feel the more we talk, the more we see that we are not very different alike, if that makes sense. Our thoughts are similar. And the more people hear this, the more they see, okay, they are alike. Doesn't mean that they are twins, but means that, okay, coaches actually have the same, you know, thought process. Because sometimes when kids come definitely on our campus, on your campus, And we had this conversation, you think, ah, they tell that to everybody, or they're just trying to sell the program. But after they hear this, they're going to be like, okay, they actually have the same line of thoughts. It's not just the coach who's telling me on individual meetings that transfer portal is a scary place. You know, it's all the coaches are thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's good for people to hear this, because it's important, I think. Helps everybody, I think.
For sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're a ex-professional player that had a different journey than I did to get here and coaching a Division II women's team. And I'm just a kid from Virginia, grew up here playing high school soccer and club soccer, and I coach Division III men. And we are saying the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And, you're right. I mean, this is the whole point of this. You know, it'd be nice to send this message out to everybody so that they can see this and help make them, you know, make a better decision, or make the best decision, I should say.
Yeah. And also, let me add one thing that we're talking about this generation. A big challenge that I feel that this generation faces is the opportunity, if that makes sense. Like, that happens a lot during the games and stuff. Let's say, you know, you two both play the same position and Scott is a starter, you know, and Scott is definitely by far the best player.
Most likely.
And Scott gets injured and she's, you know, jumps in and start playing and he's being outstanding. I mean, he's playing great. You come back off injury and you go to the portal because, well, I'm not a star anymore. The coach is just being an idiot. The coach is not playing anymore. Kids don't understand that it's about the opportunity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're the best man for the job, but you didn't get the opportunity yet. You know? And that comes with what you're saying. You know, the kids, this generation, don't want to put sometimes the work and, you know, outwork people to try to get to that standard where they want to be. You know? It's a big challenge as well.
Yeah,
big challenge for us coaches to deal with that.
Yeah, I don't know you guys dealing with that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
The whole instant gratification thing. So, anything else?
That was good.
You guys good?
Yeah. Good chatting with you, Felipe. That was awesome.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to the Tales from the Trail podcast by Matchplay. If you're enjoying the podcast and find it valuable, please consider visiting buymeacoffee.com/matchplay. These small donations collectively help offset costs and other expenses associated with production of the podcast, so I can continue to offer this service for free. Please take an extra minute to rate and review the podcast where you listen. This is a huge help. Share the podcast with whomever you think would be interested and will help in their process. Check us out on matchplayrecruit.com for our social media links. See you on the trail.